Hello and welcome to another episode of the Life Well Live podcast. I am your host, Shane Breslin. My guest on this week's episode is someone who I confess I only came across online relatively recently. But when I delved into his back catalogue, so to speak, I quickly realised he was someone who has been offering a whole lot of value in some really important areas for us in humanity as a whole. He is Dr. Todd Dewitt, and as he says to me in this episode, he's now on career number 3, having spent time with some of the major consulting firms earlier in his career before a stint in academia. That career number 3 is writing, speaking, and overall being a thought leader in some important areas for how we live and work in the world. Dr. Dewitt is a decorated former management professor, as I've said. He is a global leader in online education, and he's a renowned professional speaker. And his insights have been highlighted everywhere from the New York Times to CNN to Inside Quest, Tom Bilyeu's popular and well-respected YouTube series for entrepreneurs. Dr. Dewitt has published a number of books on leadership and life, including The Little Black Book of Leadership, which aims to give recently promoted managers the practical skills they need to succeed in their new role. And I can attest from experience how vital and valuable that would have been for me earlier in my career. And also Show Your Ink, which encourages us to own our true authenticity, to use our mistakes to serve us, and to outline our own personal values in order to be our best selves in work and the world at large. Overall, we spend roughly a third of our lives at work, and in the 80-hour-a-week hustle and grind culture that has taken hold of so much of the Western world, at least, that percentage is obviously closer to half. So it's no wonder that our work not only defines us in some significant way, but also influences our sense of fulfillment and happiness, perhaps more than any other thing in our lives. We talk about the definitions of good leadership, about the increasing role of technology in the workplace and its effects on our happiness and productivity. We talk about job satisfaction and what good leaders can proactively do to help foster that for their teams. We talk about lots more besides, and I hope you really enjoy it. I really got a lot out of this chat, and I hope that you do too. So without further ado, on to this week's show with author, speaker, leadership prophet, and authenticity evangelist, Dr. Todd Dewitt. Todd, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Life Well Live podcast. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about Dr. Todd Dewitt. What's your background? Where did you come from?
I'm probably one of the luckiest people you'll ever meet. I'm on career 3 at this point. I bet you I have at least 4 before I'm done. The first career after going to college and studying business and then getting an MBA was consulting. So I worked with Anderson and Ernst & Young, the big boys. I think there's 4 of them left at this point. And that was educational in a difficult way, because what I learned was that smart people are interesting and frankly, relationships are tough in professional life, and I didn't fit in traditional corporate roles. And so that led to the next career, which was to leave corporate America and go back to the ivory tower. So I went and got a PhD at Texas A&M in organizational behavior, which is kind of the business school's version of applied psychology, if you will, studying people at work and teams and leadership. And loved that. Finished that, did a postdoctoral fellowship for a year, and then I had to get a real job as a professor, which was great. And I went to Ohio, a place called Wright State University, which I just loved for 10 years, and was a full professor, and for a short while I was a dean and some other things. It was great. I loved writing dorky papers for intellectuals, and I loved teaching graduate students things about people and relationships and leadership. And then, as you well know, Shane, life happens in ways you can't predict. I thought that I was going to do that until I was 75 and then kind of retire and then give me a watch or something. And life happened. What happened was that the phone started to ring, and people who were former students or who knew former students started saying, hey, you know, I've got this meeting and we need a speaker. And I heard you were a loud, funny storyteller guy. Would you come out and give a talk? And I started giving talks, and it was for free for the first couple of years because, well, I guess that's what rookies do. We thought it was just pure service, which is great, until some guy offered to pay me. I'll never forget this true story. He said, great, you're booked. Thank you. Listen, though, we've only got $300. Will that be enough? And it was the first time somebody paid me to tell stories, and I thought to myself, you've got to be kidding me. This is absurd. And that just grew and grew to the point that I had to retire from that career to make time for speaking and writing and related activities, which is what I do full time now.
Amazing. And you said how much you loved the university life and the academic life. Is there one thing that you miss the most about that?
I miss the better conversations with students. Now, I love my current career more than I've loved any career, but I do miss certain things about being on campus. There's an energy and a youthful intellectual exuberance that is fun to be around. And even though right now, thanks to many courses I have at LinkedIn, I receive fan mail every single day from somebody who wants to say thanks for this course or that course. The truth is, sitting down with those humans on a regular basis and hearing how it applies to their very specific lives and their very specific problems at work was a treat, and I do miss that.
Interesting. I often think of when I speak to people that have that third level academic university level experience, I often think of the section in Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich about the tenured professors and how they have, and I'm going to paraphrase, they have access to an incredible amount of specialist knowledge, but they might not have the general, and I could be flip-flopping these, but might not have the general knowledge required to make a really broad success, but they might be very, very good at one particular thing that might not be able to translate. I've probably butchered that a little bit, but it is interesting to me. I've seen lots of professors, lots of people in academia that are incredibly bright and incredibly talented, but in a strange way, are often sometimes not able to translate that into kind of real world.
You'll notice my answer to your question about what I miss wasn't my colleagues. So I'll be honest with you. I met some amazing people, but there is truth to what you're suggesting. They are highly specialized. And I think it's part of being in the academy, being in the ivory tower. They're sometimes full of themselves and lacking real world applicability, real world knowledge. And maybe that's okay. As researchers trying to create knowledge, they need a lot of sitting alone and thinking deep. And I get that. So they play a very important role, but sometimes they do look a lot like you said.
You mentioned, and you brought us up to speed in terms of what you're doing now, you're writing, teaching online, speaking. What's taken up most of your time, or what are you most excited about right now, I suppose?
I'm most excited about a very, very, very big risk I'm taking. I have decided to listen to a whole lot of people who have given me advice over the years, who are in my audiences and who read the books. And what they have said is, hey, man, you're not just a leadership guy. You're so clearly a relationship expert. And I resisted that for a while, and that came from the ivory tower, because I know what kind of degree I have and the courses I taught, and I knew I was in business school, etc. And then I just kind of looked at what I was saying and looked at what I was writing and looked at what people are asking me. And over a few years, I realized, well, they're right. I am a relationship guy more than anything else. And so I'm writing a new book. I've got one chapter left. It's called The 10 Delusions. And it's a relationship book about anyone who's interested in marriage or a long-term partnership. And it's what I've learned, plus some honest, good expert advice from those folks as well. And it's lively and practical and in your face. And I'm very excited because when I do this, and it's on the website, and people who look at me will see it, it will be, for better or for worse, a shift away from just saying I am a leadership expert. And I'm very excited about that. I'm not sure I fully understand the implications or risks yet, but I'm excited.
Excellent. I'd like to delve deeper into what you're working on there in that book. But you mentioned that this is a risk because it's bringing you away from what you've become known for. And what you've become known for is, I think it's fair to say, your work in leadership teams, success in business and life, I suppose. When it comes to leadership, how would you describe what leadership is, for one, and number two, what good leadership is?
Sure. Well, yeah, it's a great way to phrase it. Well, leadership is about trying to accomplish goals through other people, hopefully in very positive ways. It's been defined many ways, but I think that actually just captures the essence of it. You can have a formal position or just influence due to personality or expertise, but it's influence over someone trying to marshal people forward towards a collective goal. It could be a nonprofit, could be a corporation. That's what it is. Now, the more interesting question, which you kind of hinted at, is how are we doing at this thing called leadership? And I say with tongue in cheek, I try to laugh at our problems sometimes. You know what? If we were doing it really well, I wouldn't have a career. That's just the fact. If this was easy, there would not be an industry of people like me talking about it. So the truth is that we have this thing called personality, and it's a very real set of tendencies each one of us have, and each one of us is different. And we take it into a group of people, all of whom have different personalities. Somehow getting them to communicate effectively and marshal forward towards goals is actually very difficult. So in practice, it is a radical scattershot of people who don't get it, people who do damage through just being loud and blunt and not so nice, all the way on the other spectrum. There is a wonderful, still too small, but emerging group of people who care about answering this question, care about getting it right, care about developing others and making their life more than just something they endure. In fact, maybe you have some purpose. So there's a broad spectrum in practice that you'll see for sure.
And when it comes to good leadership, is there a framework that people can typically follow that might allow them to lead well in practice, irrespective of the team or the type of team they're trying to lead?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. There are millions of answers to it. Plenty of good books and frameworks out there. Offline, we had talked about six leadership styles. That's been talked about. There's many like that. I, of course, would be remiss if I didn't say, hey, I've got a book called The Little Black Book of Leadership, which actually lays out a nice approach to thinking through leadership. There are many like that. I think if you start with a couple basic ideas, which is it's about them, not you. I need to communicate more, not less. We're in this together. I'm not above them. If you start with a few honestly simple ideas like that and learn how to live them, well, you're going to be okay as a leader, but you know, easier to say than do because people have their persnickety personalities. They have fires everywhere every day. They're so busy, they forget the core elements of what it means to positively relate to another human being. And so they don't act on those ideas. I mean, there's a reason Stephen Covey wrote Seven Habits and got famous, and others like him, when he said, hey, begin with the end in mind, seek to serve others, all of those things. Very basic ideas that we often neglect because we're wired to not think about them, and because we're busy, gets us in deep, deep trouble. So I would say start with focusing on them, how you can help them, how you can improve them, how you can be of service to them. And that's a heck of a great place to start thinking about being an effective leader.
Okay. And so practically speaking, to give a little bit of context before I ask this question, I believe, and part of the, why I was so interested to speak to you, is that this whole podcast is about overcoming challenges of life. And I think the one inevitability in every single day is that we're going to have challenges. And a lot of days, if we're lucky, those challenges will be small, but occasionally mammoth challenges will come along that we're going to have to find a way past. So overcoming the challenges, and I guess exploring and embracing our unique selves. And one of the big challenges for that is how we fit into this often artificial construct that is the workplace, and how we fit into teams with a leader or a set of leaders at the helm and colleagues alongside. And the question I was going to ask was, in terms of practically speaking, beginning with the end of mind and thinking about them, not you, they are simple in concept, but difficult often in practice. So are there some simple methodologies or practices that a leader can implement today, this week, that will immediately make them a more empathetic or better leader?
Well, there's no magic bullet. I've said this a million times. There's no magic bullet. Leadership success really is best defined as the cumulative effect of many small things done correctly over time. I do believe that. I think most people agree. The answer to your question, though, is that there's plenty. For example, just to be more present and in the moment, and you can do that, for example, by using technology to communicate less and face-to-face more. If you honestly want to connect with people, understand them, be of service to them to help them do their jobs, get out of your office more, get away from that computer screen more, and go check in with people with no expectations, with no helicopter hovering where you're monitoring their performance. You're actually just saying, hi, what's going on? Can I help you with anything? Are things going like they should? And when they believe, when they smell sincerity on you, it's amazing how they'll open up in ways they otherwise would not. So, I mean, if you really gave me only one answer to that question, I would say go have face-to-face human contact more than you are now.
Okay, really interesting. And that brings me to something that I wanted to speak about anyway, in terms of technology in the workplace and also the increasing tendency towards remote teams and teams that are distributed, spread, maybe often right across the globe. If we take that in turn, I've seen it with my own eyes in offices where person A that sits 5 feet away from person B and they're communicating, the only way to communicate is through Slack or Instant Messenger and various things like that. What do you put that down to? Or how is it possible to limit the onset of this technological kind of dragon that seems to be pulling everybody down?
You know, it's a fascinating question. Technology itself is hugely fascinating. I give you the punchline because there's a bunch of social scientists who've studied this. The punchline tends to be that technology, while it has great potential, has not created new levels of productivity the way we kind of thought it would, because it can be abused as much as it can be used correctly. I think we understand that when we think about it for just a minute. So you have a couple choices there. You can mandate certain types of performance behaviors, or you can model the way. Now, too many leaders err on mandating. Here's the new rule. You people are too stupid to talk to each other, so now we're going to ban blah, 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 or limit blah, 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 and force you to blah, 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 because it's good for you. There's a million versions of that that kind of come from a good place that are not terribly effective because no adult ever has enjoyed being treated like a child and told what to do. The best way, difficult, sure, but the best way is to model the behavior. So for example, when I talked about going out and increasing the human-to-human contact points, well, that is modeling the behavior. That says to a person who's interacting with you, and especially to the people watching you who aren't interacting with you, because they can learn vicariously, no risk in the game, but they can learn about you and what matters just by seeing you. That's huge. We know this as researchers, and I think it's common sense in this case, that the more people see you modeling certain behaviors at work, the more likely they're to follow suit themselves. So for what it's worth, mandates tend to not work. You need to go show them what great looks like and see if they'll learn to follow the way.
Okay. The second part of that, in terms of the increasing development of remote teams, have you experienced this? What have you seen up close? Because I know that there's several remote teams that would classify, and I've seen the staff describing it's an amazing work environment, and they all come together once every 12 months or whatever in one place, and everything is really great because they can keep overhead down and keep productivity high. I'm sure there are downsides of isolation and being spread around the place and just not working with people who you almost never see. Have you come across challenges in terms of leadership and team dynamics in a remote environment? And if so, what are the ways around them?
Sure. It's a popular topic. It hasn't grown as quickly as people thought, but it is still growing and interesting because we can do it so effortlessly now thanks to technology. Not a radically unique set of challenges. Usually they're the same, give or take, types of challenges you have in a team, but they're simply harder to deal with because of distance. In fact, I have a course on this topic at LinkedIn Learning if anyone's interested. But the answer is, we didn't talk about this earlier and it fits in though, the answer is connectivity and purpose. Connectivity is just a transaction. It can happen in different ways, daily calls, video, phone, Slack, a million things like we know. We have different ways now. And that is one of the keys, not to use one, which becomes a routine and a bore to the brain. We want to use multiple channels, different ways to do this to keep people somehow attentive. That's the minimal thing you got to do. But the maximum thing to make a team of remote people care is purpose. Purpose is hard to define, but it's absolutely integral to success. Now, what I mean by that is that any job, you used the word, I think, contrived a little while ago, you're talking about the fake nature of work, and that's a bold statement, and you're right. We would not go to that office with those brown cubes for any other reason than the fact that I need that paycheck. We're friends with people I may not have ever met ever had not I been chasing that paycheck over there. I understand that, and that's a bold, honest thing to say. So what can you do to take the absurdity of that reality and make it palatable, if not acceptable? I mean, really acceptable. And the answer, the best answer, is purpose. So for example, do you think that, I used to ask students this all the time, do you think that sanitation workers, garbage men and garbage women, do you think that they have systematically lower job satisfaction because they have a dirty job no one wants? A lot of people want to say, yeah, I bet they do. And the answer is no, you're wrong. They don't have some systematically lower, this has been studied, lower job satisfaction. It is meaningfully dependent team to team based on the relationship with their supervisor. Same goes for bankers who make $1 million a year. They could be low, not just high because they're wealthy and successful. They could be low, again, based on the quality of the relationship with their direct supervisor, which is the most important relationship out there. So if it's the most important relationship and they do have power, which is what those studies would suggest, then what can you do to help them? Well, you convey purpose. The garbage men who have high satisfaction when they subjectively rate how they like their job, they're folks who don't see themselves as garbage men in a dirty job. They are folks who see themselves as genuinely adding value to community that needs to get done to keep everyone happy, and they see value in that. That's purpose. A boss for any vocation has an opportunity to try and define the higher level purpose that we're happily serving. And if they can do that effectively and be believed, you'll see people happy to do that work in that contrived place they otherwise wouldn't go.
It's a fascinating thing. So my hypothesis, and I haven't studied this at all, it's just like I've studied this by experience and that's all, is that I feel a lot of the sense of detachment and even apathy that people in the workplace experience is the sense that irrespective of what they're doing, it doesn't really matter in terms of their tiny cog in this massive machine that might be delivering something big, but it might be 4 months, 6 months, 12 months into the future. And actually, what is the purpose or the meaning of my little day's work in this big hole. Whereas the bin man, as we say in Ireland, or the garbage collector in the US, has a very clear sense of cause and effect. They've done something and they've had an effect at the end of that day. They've achieved something. I've thought of this in terms of even gardening, like spending a day in the garden, you can see the fruits of your labor. Are there roles for leadership in this conundrum, or is that something we all as individuals really need to take more responsibility about?
The answer is yes. The way I would phrase it is that leaders have an opportunity to connect people to the outcomes they help eventually create. So let me give you an example, because boy, are you correct. Any educated, hardworking person working in a cube farm, that's what I call them, cube land or cube farm, can get that sense of detachment. What did I do today? I pushed some paperwork. Did I change the world today? Did I do anything? What am I doing? You're right. So let me give you one example, which is the creative task that faces any leader, same task at a generic level. So I knew a person who was a student who thought about what you're talking about, and then they looked at their employees out there in Cube Land, and they were purchasing professionals for the government for a large Air Force base. And they saw that detachment, that cold look like, oh, are they feeling purpose? I don't think so. Uh-oh. And what they decided to do one day, which is just one example, and it only has a temporary effect, but it's beautiful, and you can come up with other examples. They invited two fighter pilots, because the purchasing mostly for what this group was doing had to do with parts, supplies, and other things that support our fighting fleet. They brought in two fighter pilots who then they gathered everyone around. It was unannounced. And they said to everyone, I'm so-and-so, here's what I do. And I have to tell you, I'm grateful for my job. I believe in what we do. And there is no way I could ever do it if not for the contribution that you guys make. I know you sit here sometimes and wonder about the effect of what you do. I'm here to tell you, you keep me safe and capable to do my job. It's very important to all of us. And I want to tell you, thank you. It was a beautiful short connection to the outcome that made that cube feel entirely different after it was over. That is the creative opportunity leaders have to figure out for themselves job by job.
That's a great example, and thanks for sharing that. If we dip into your books and can do a scattergun approach here, The Little Black Book of Leadership, if there are, and I know that you have Jewett's Rules and New Manager Survival Guide, and let's talk about new managers in a second, but what would you say the central theme or message of your Little Black Book of Leadership is?
Well, thanks for asking. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's kind of funny, to be frank. It started as me trying to give something to my students, because teaching MBA students, Masters of Business students, the textbooks were very expensive and fat and bloated with things I didn't think were always useful. And I felt bad that they were having to take their little bits of money and spend it on this thing. And so I wrote this book to be a beautiful, no fluff reduction of a textbook. Here's the 101, what you need to know, Mr. MBA student. And I gave it to them for free, and they started giving it out to others, and then it grew. Anyhow, I think there's a lot of ways to try and summarize it. Probably my favorite you just mentioned, which I arrogantly called Jewett's Rules. And I think they're terribly useful when you're looking for a place to start thinking about doing leadership correctly. And they are extremely simple. It's about reducing ambiguity, being fair, and staying positive. Reducing ambiguity in everything you do, an email, a talk, any interaction, period, with your folks. Are you clarifying and helping them understand better, or are you muddying the waters? And if you think in terms of that question, you'll realize sometimes that you're doing more muddying than you think. So the answer is always to attempt to add clarity to them in all that you do. Reduce ambiguity. Be fair. Fairness isn't really about everyone getting equal outcomes. It's about equal opportunity, and it's about transparency and giving people an opportunity to do their job right because you're keeping them informed with the right resources, etc. That's fair. Reduce ambiguity. Be fair. And the last one, which is my favorite, no matter how simplistic it sounds, I mean, I really do mean this, stay positive. Emotions are a very, very real thing at work. And we know with a lot of certainty at this point how they affect productivity and other outcomes. And the boss, men, women who have positions of formal leadership, they are the creators and the limiters, frankly, of the experience of positive emotion. They have great power to dampen negative emotion. They have great power to create and sustain and share positive emotion. And when you remind people of that and you keep it conscious in their head, they're more likely to try and act in a way that does, in fact, help positive emotion exist, from smiling to pats on the backs to sharing good news to et cetera, et cetera. So I honestly think those three rules, as simple as they sound, are a heck of a good start to thinking about leadership.
Okay. And on the third one there about the positive emotions, obviously, managers and leaders have a capacity to influence that. I totally accept that. Where would you say on the scale of responsibility for managing our emotions, the personal responsibility of the staff, team members, employees sits?
I think everyone has a responsibility for sure. I'm a huge believer in personal responsibility in life, period. It's also true that leaders are supposed to be building the village. They're supposed to be helping the team. They have a bigger responsibility, is a simple way to say it. So I think if I was talking to a group of leaders, that you didn't see this in the job description, but it is a huge part of what you do. Not everyone agrees identically on this issue, but I'm just going to be honest with you. Life is precious. We spend a huge bunch of it in this place with semi-strangers. Well, it's incumbent on you guys to make it not foreign, not strange, maybe even leaning towards purpose and positivity. And if you can pull that off, two big words, purpose, positivity, if you can pull that off, people move from what I call mere compliance, hey, I'll do what I was told to do for my paycheck, towards this thing that is beautiful, that's much more rare, called commitment, meaning I get it, I'm in it, I'm with you, I even kind of like this sometimes, I'm glad to be here. Those are two radically different things. People start as employees generally closer to compliant, and then leadership's opportunity is to move them towards commitment.
Amazing. What percentage of leaders or people in leadership roles would you say are really good leaders?
That's a difficult question. I'm not aware of any science that tries to answer that. I would have to say, honestly, give or take, it's 50-50. And when I say 50-50, I'm not saying 50% are great. I'm saying 50% are above being bad managers. Bad managers who upset people, make lives difficult to live, and increase voluntary turnover. But when you're above that 50 percentile, that means you're at a minimum, and this goes a long way, you're trying, and people kind of know you're trying, and you want to do the right thing, even if you're not great at it yet. And then, of course, there's higher levels that hit the aspirations we've been talking about.
So anecdotally, at least, it's your hypothesis or what your experience, and this I would share this, that at least half managers are below average and really bad leaders.
I would say there's a spectrum for sure, but at least half of them have major problems in how they approach the craft, yes.
Talk to me about the new manager and the new manager survival guide, because I was a new manager in one of my previous roles, and I didn't know what to do. I was good at the role that I was promoted from, into a role that I believed I should be able to do because I was good at the previous role, but I didn't know how to be the new manager. And I was trying to fake it till I make it and pretending my way through it and just failing my team and failing everybody around me. That's what I felt. And I didn't last very long. I left that after about 6 months. So is there a mechanism or an ideal route or framework for new managers to really become the manager and leader that they can be? And what is the role that their higher ups, I suppose, play in that process?
First of all, the higher-ups are supposed to develop and promote people correctly. That's a big question mark right there. Many times the person promoted is promoted for the wrong reasons, because they were good at their job. And hey, that guy's a great accountant. He's just been spectacular. Let's make him the new head of accounting because the other guy's retiring. Thinking like that's very common and very unproductive because what you just said a minute ago is so good. The truth is that doing your job, engineer, accounting, whatever, is radically different than running the team who's doing that job. They are different skill sets. So the first thing I say to aspirational leaders who've not yet been promoted is what you're doing now is not proof that you'll be successful then. There is a different set of skills, and it is all based on people skills and communication for the most part. So for new manager survival, you don't come in and immediately shake things up. You don't come in and start barking orders. You come in and you humble yourself. Now, you can be confident and positive. That's important. You want them to respect you. But you humble yourself and you say, you know what? This is the first time I've run this crew. You guys clearly know a lot more than I do, and I need to see if I can't get my hands around that. You say that to them collectively. Then you have one-on-ones, standard practice, one-on-ones with everyone to say, let me do my best to sit here and be quiet and take notes. Explain to me the boundaries of your role, what you do. And then in that conversation, you got to ask them what's working and what's not working and what you would like the leader of this group to understand. Simple, open-ended, now you're quiet, they're talking. This is building rapport like a quality adult. You do that across the whole team, and then you make sure in the first few months to give them props for what they're doing right, celebrate, in fact, anything that's recent history that's been a big win for them, and tell them your goal is to build on that and perpetuate what they've already clearly created. You hear everything I'm saying? It's clearly not about me, it's about them. Again, it's always about them. So I would say don't ever take that job unless you understand that what got you there is no longer good enough, because I don't care how great a technician you are at your job. Now it's about self-reflection and looking in the mirror. It's about listening. It's about feedback. It's about communication. It's all people skills from here on out if you're going to accept that title and a couple extra bucks to be the leader of the team.
Are there some resources or things that people can read, watch, study that would help them with that transition?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be selfish again. I'll mention mine and then maybe a couple others. Certainly, I've got a course, very popular, millions of people watch it, called New Manager Fundamentals at LinkedIn Learning. A lot of people find that to be a quality 101 dose that gets them moving. But there's much more famous examples to answer your question. The first 90 days, if I remember correctly, I'm blanking on the author. Who was that? Buckingham, maybe? I can't remember.
Not sure.
First 90 days, something like that. There's plenty of books, very niched out and dedicated to your first few months, let's call it, of being a new leader and the behaviors that get you up to speed and establish rapport with your team. In fact, if they'll just pull out their favorite search engine, look up new manager books or look up the first 90 days as a good example, they're going to find plenty.
Excellent. Michael Watkins, I think, is the first 90 days. Talk to me about how we might go about building a great team and how we might play a part in a great team if we're not the one building it.
Well, I'll stay with the leader perspective for a minute. There's a whole bunch of it that we've talked about, and a big piece we had, and we talked about rapport and it's about them, not you, et cetera. There's a big piece we haven't talked about, and that's accountability. Now, there's a myth out there. People listen to people like me, and they think that I'm just preaching kumbaya and positive vibes and so on. Well, by the way, I am preaching those things. But I also believe in performance excellence. And what that means on great teams, and this is fun to share, is that leaders are not bashful to hold themselves to high standards, number one, and to define goals, standards, expectations for team members that are real and that are challenging. Goals are not supposed to be easy or impossible. They're supposed to be challenging, generally speaking. And here's the beauty. When you're holding yourself to high standards, others get it and do not resist or resent you for holding them to high standards. And then this is a big word too, consistency. When they see you on performance standards, hold people in similar ways, hold them accountable, they believe in the system that you're perpetuating as fair. There's that word again. And when they sense fairness, man, believe me, behaviors are just better at work when people believe they're on the fair end of a deal. So you got to have accountability beyond all the people communication related things we've been talking about. And in high performing teams, they do not resent that at all, because it becomes a shared value over time, because we're all in this together.
Lots of people have said this in various guises and in various ways, but hiring people that, in effect, making yourself the least knowledgeable person on the team, if you know what I mean. So hiring the specialists or the people that the best skill sets to fill the best roles.
Yeah, the best managers make themselves slowly obsolete over time because they always bring in better people. That's the brave manager. I think it's a strong minority of them, but yes, that is the goal we should be chasing.
Talk to me about where this is going. There's a massive move towards entrepreneurship and what might be described as solopreneurship, so single person companies, people working alone or solo. There's also the gig economy of freelancers. Do you see that shift continuing or increasing pace away from the 3,000, 30,000, 300,000 person workplace? Or will that always be a very, very fundamental part of the wider economy?
It's a great question. I'm certainly not an economist, but I'll take a stab at it. I think they're both growing, meaning the middle is going bye-bye as people cling on to the mega companies or try to join the gig economy. There's some truth to that. Is that going to change? It's actually a hugely debated topic, because there's a confluence of I'm really just as an observer very interested in this because it does impact my area. There's a big debate going on about how to answer your question, and no one can predict the future. But you have futurists and economists and other observers who are trying to do that. And they're looking at the confluence of AI and levels of employment, various types of technologies other than AI, and how they're pushing us to need fewer people to do the work that we do. So that's the long-term concern. It's a very, very real concern as we watch jobs in the States anyway, jobs consistently start to disappear thanks to technology. I think that for those who stay engaged in the labor pool, you're going to see a continuation of remote or remote part-time work anyway for the folks who stay with the big companies and more individual type companies. I think companies are going to find it advantageous to push that, because when they don't have a full-time employee but they get the value from them, that's the contract worker phenomenon. In the States, that's a big deal. I'm not sure how it plays out in Europe. they see as simple economic value in that because they get what they need, but they don't have to pay as much. I hate to say it so crudely, but that's what they see when they look at the numbers. So I think it's going to increase for a variety of those reasons.
Yeah. And the whole thing about AI and job replacement, I suppose, I think it was Yuval Noah Hariri was talking about the most important skill sets to have as the 21st century continues are adaptability and resilience. And they're the things that we should be training ourselves in now so that we can shift into whatever environment is going to be in 5-10 years time because it's changing so rapidly.
If you were going to have a conversation in the States and you look at all the issues we face, we have plenty of challenges, as you know, what's the biggest challenge that we should be facing? It's actually a topic not being addressed at all. And that truly embarrasses me and kind of makes me angry. And the issue is education. We have, long story short, K through 12, youngins through high school. We have a what's considered widely to be terribly, terribly mediocre system. And that is the biggest problem for our future workforce by far because of issues like the one you just raised. Because we're not teaching those things. We're actually teaching the opposite very often.
Yeah, and it's not dissimilar here. Well, the systems, differences and contrasts, I guess, but not dissimilar in terms of outcome. There's a big focus on exam results and in creating employees for certain technological sectors or STEM sectors, but maybe at the expense of actually building the maybe resilience or emotional intelligence or adaptability of the individual person. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out for sure. I want to talk about your next book or one of your other books, which is the Show Your Ink. So this, I guess, is a lot about authenticity. Describe for me, if you can, the role of authenticity or why it's important to be authentic in the workplace environment.
The truth is that when you look at people at work and you study them, you find out that people rightly, understandably, manage impressions. They tend to want to understand and adhere to social norms because they see it as advantageous, or at a minimum, they see it as staying out of trouble in terms of relationship dynamics at work. That's logical, but the observation that's so clear is that people radically overindulge in managing impressions to the point that most people at work have distant, cold, measured, impersonal relationships that don't look warm and fuzzy in the least. I have to be clear, I'm not encouraging anyone to try and become best friends with people at work. I've never said that, never will. It can be a disaster because we see friends with rosy colored glasses, so to speak. But we do know that the average relationship is measured, distant, cold, and unfulfilling as anything. And so what I advocate through authenticity is pushing that average forward towards a positive professional relationship, not best friends, but a positive professional relationship whereby some of the humanity that is you can be known and talked about and expressed and displayed, as opposed to utter censoring and distant relationships, which does dominate most workplaces. So authenticity is about being a little less measured and plastic, which comes from a good place, but we do it too much, and a little more human and honest about who you are, what you think, and how you like to present yourself. And it turns out, on average, people respect and enjoy authenticity, and they like to reciprocate.
Because it is true, because we're not hiding our real selves. And I know, like, hiding and wearing those masks and veneers can be really exhausting over time, I guess. I've read Seth Godin on this, and he has some interesting things to say about authenticity and that how I think, and I'm going to paraphrase again, that authenticity is really overblown and that he doesn't want an authentic surgeon. He wants a professional. When he goes into the hospital, he wants somebody to be there and do their job and not to tell them about their fishing trip, effectively. So.
But would you like to tell you why Seth Godin is wrong?
Please.
I'm on the record telling you Seth Godin is wrong. What we know is that one of the variables among many that doctors are judged by from the patient perspective is their bedside manner. Not a very technical word, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. Patients very often make difficult care-related decisions based not on credentials and professional aptitude, but based on bedside manner. The guy who talks about his fishing trip is going to build more rapport and patients are going to like them more. Now, assuming he's a good surgeon, that's a hell of an attribute to have. So in general, while I'm a huge fan of Mr. Godin, that advice is a little over the top. I know the point he's making, but in essence, I don't think it's accurate because we know that patients are influenced by the human qualities doctors show, not just their skills.
Excellent. So Seth Godin, consider yourself refuted. Are there downsides? Can we be too authentic in our professional environment?
You know, I think that might be one of the most common questions I get. And the answer is absolutely yes. So as I described it a little while ago, we're trying to move that average from where we know it is towards a happier medium in between cold and distant and best friend. The truth is, we know a few people, let's not call them by name, people with whom we've worked, who we don't want to hear more about who they are, and we don't want them to be more expressive. There are some odd people, and I have to admit, there are some very, very difficult people. They're a minority, we all know this, but they exist in most teams, certainly in all organizations. And for them, no, we don't want them to let the wall down and be radically authentic tomorrow. We think that would probably be problematic. So I love to admit that. It's obvious and true, but I do not think, and I've said this a million times, you can't let that reality, their existence, stop you from embracing this concept, because they're this many, just a few people, really, a small group of people. And if you were to move the average the way I was talking about for the decent people who dominate workplaces, then you wouldn't care at all about a few loose cannons who are a little too odd, who also embrace the idea, because the average relationship, in fact, would be better and different. And in the face of that, who cares about a couple weirdos once in a while?
But to me, obvious benefits of one-to-one relationships and rapport that somebody being more authentic brings. Are there quantifiable benefits for a company that people can be more themselves in the workplace?
It's been a question for a long time. Hey, man, I'm listening to you or Godin or people like us, and you know what? Sounds good, but can you prove bottom line effectiveness? Can you prove this matters? That's a reasonable thing to say. About 50, 60 years ago, it was still extremely difficult to answer that question. There are now, even though measuring variables can be difficult in studies, social sciences, there are now plenty of studies that talk about aggregate measures within organizations of people who embrace these positive, progressive types of leadership ideas we're talking about and how they relate to effectiveness. And there is some pretty consistent evidence that companies who try and develop leaders along the lines that we're talking about tend to perform better than their competition. Matter of fact, I remember when this was becoming widespread, I used a text by some really bright scholars back in the day. Cameron and Wetton were their names, and they quoted many of them, and this is 20 years ago, they quoted many of those studies. So the short answer to your question is, yes, do some Googling, you'll find the academic research. Corporations who on a regular basis adhere to some of these ideals tend to perform better. And it makes sense if you think about it, because when they actually embrace some of these concepts, guess what they do? They attract and they retain better talent, because people like to work in places defined the way that we've been discussing. And when you have a toxic work environment, what do people do? They leave. Makes sense.
Sure does. One of the things that certainly in my workplace experience, and this brings it back to artificial or contrived construct of your set working day from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. or whatever it is I guess the lack of freedom that is essential characteristic of that environment, that you have to be in a certain place at a certain time and there are certain things are expected of you. How much freedom should a good leader give his or her team?
It is absolutely central to understanding leadership and life at work. The answer to your question is as much as they can take and still perform at a high level. Let me say that again. As much as you can give and they can accept while still performing at a high level. The word the scholars use is called autonomy. You can call it in common conversation freedom. Latitude to do what you think is right any given moment of the day. And we know that that's often restricted by a million different things, including leadership practices. What the research says is that when you treat adults like adults, now there are exceptions and they better have real expectations and clarity about those expectations. But when that stuff's in place, you give real adults more autonomy instead of less autonomy. They love it. They inherently feel respected by it and they tend to perform at a higher level because they see themselves as responsible and capable just because someone treated them like an adult and gave them space to operate instead of micromanaging them.
And I guess that comes down to the key concept to bear in mind, I suppose, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the clarity of the communication of the end goal and intermediary goals, and how you get to those goals is maybe less important.
You know, I've got a bunch of key phrases I use over time to get ideas to stick in people's heads. One of them is to manage outcomes, not process. I love that as a key leadership maxim or idea. If you can define what they're trying to achieve and they have clarity and they have the resources to do the job, why would you ever go micromanage and muck around in the process of them doing the work if you didn't have to? If you're getting the outcome that you want, defined by whatever, if you're getting that thing you want done, let them go do it without you caring about how they're doing. When do you get involved in the process? When you start to not see the outcomes that you need. That's when you jump in on a micro level and start to coach and investigate, but not before.
Makes sense to me. What would you say is the biggest challenge or the most consistent challenge that you see leaders or companies trying to solve or overcome now?
Well, part of their challenge is self-created. You can do all the techniques people like me talk about. all of them. And you still have big challenges because, well, corporations have created a trust issue in many ways as they shift jobs because they care about, this is the allegation from a lot of people, they care about profit and loss statements, financial statements more than they do people. I think there's some truth to that. I think that you have to look at enlightened companies, if there is such a thing, to get around that. Pick on my favorite because they are progressive, and that's LinkedIn. I've been out to LinkedIn many times, met a lot of their executives, and they are striving to act every day on these ideas because they believe in people in a truly impressive way. And what you see there is that they attract the best talent in the world, and no one ever wants to leave there, which they all could because they're so accomplished and they have a big brand and they could all jump, but they don't jump like people do at other companies because they know that where they're at is meaningful and they're served well. So the biggest challenge at the macro level, and we're outside of my expertise, is to balance the need to shift on a global basis the way we need to shift sometimes while having employees truly believe that you care about them. And that is immensely different to do because if you want to stay, and I don't blame them, but I don't like some of their decisions. I mean, if you're making products over here in this town and there's 3,000 people who are employed and you can do it cheaper somewhere else, and you go do that, what do you expect people to think? Well, you expect them to feel slighted, of course, because you've taken away their livelihood. So there's the large macro answer to your question. At the micro level, you have a different challenge. The biggest challenge for a leader at the micro level every day in corporate America today or global companies anywhere is the massive generational shift that's about to happen. We are at the very, very front end of a huge change in the labor pool, whereby gray hairs are going to retire in the millions, and what we call millennials and Gen Z are going to take over in proportions never before seen. So the word is diversity. We've talked about it for 30 years, and we've done a mediocre job of it, according to most people who have studied the topic in terms of the numbers. What you're going to see in the next few years as a challenge for day-to-day operational leadership is a huge influx of diversity. Young people, women, minorities are going to take over in proportions never seen before because of the retirement of the boomers, at least in the States. And many countries are following suit as well. And you either understand and are eager to get involved in seeing a more diverse workforce and understanding what that is, or you're freaked out, which happens too, and you don't understand it, you don't have the skill set to deal with it. So getting people to understand, care about, and deal with increasing diversity is going to be a core trait for success in the next two decades.
Yeah, there is a lot of discussion and a lot of debate around opportunities for, and even quotas for females on boards of directors and minorities and ethnic minorities. But when that shift starts to happen without any artificial constructs making it happen, it'll be fascinating to see where that goes.
No doubt.
Before we finish up, let's talk about what you're working on right now. So you mentioned at the start, The 10 Delusions, I think you said the name of their next book will be, and it's a shift of focus for you from leadership into relationships. If you could give a sense of some of the 10 delusions and why they're important when it comes to relationships.
Well, the front part of the book talks about the delusions, and basically I'm making fun of and trying to be practical about the reality of relationships. So the truth is, this has just been studied so many different ways. We fall in love, and when that happens, a bizarre thing happens between human beings. There is quite literally a chemical explosion. I call it, the chemical cloud in our heads, in a literal sense. And it's not unlike controlled substances and how they influence us. And it makes us literally see people differently than we otherwise would when these chemicals are not going and exploding in our heads. And so delusions emerge that are silly, such as, I know this person really, really well. No, you don't. No, you don't. That takes 10 years. This is the way I feel now is clearly the way I'm going to feel forever. No, you won't. Or I do see one flaw, which makes me feel like I'm a relationship expert. I do see one flaw, but I know I can fix that. There are some very common, very problematic, sometimes destructive delusions that are extremely common when we're going through that mental state. And then after you get through the honeymoon period in any relationship and the chemicals go back to normal, the ones that exploded when you, quote, fell in love, new delusions emerge because you start to see, you're back to your baseline. You start to see more clearly than you did when you had the chemical haze. And to cope with that reality, which looks a lot different than you thought it would, there's new delusions that emerge, which is, I can change them, or I'm imperfect too, so I'll justify all of their shortcomings because I'm also full of shortcomings. And they're not terribly productive to cling to as far as relationship answers. So what I try to do in the book is just have fun pointing out some of the fallacies of thinking that we all fall prey to pretty typically in relationships, and try and provide the readers, more importantly, a way around them, some lucidity with them, but then some practical ways to start meaningful conversations and look at our behaviors and think about the behaviors that actually push relationships into some level of sustainability. So it's a practical, fun take on the realities of love and relationships.
I think it's fair to say that the realm of love and relationships, the preponderance has been towards the female leaders and female voices in this space. Do you feel that you're speaking to or getting the ear of more men when you talk about this?
I get more men in my audience traditionally because they dominate leadership roles still. But that's not who I get the best response from. See, I talk about what you might call progressive issues and emotions and these types of things. They resonate with women more than men. I pull the men in because they need to hear this, and I love doing that, especially when someone thank you later. But more innately, the women get it. And the research, by the way, is starting to emerge that suggests that they're going to be better leaders than men anyway, for a variety of reasons. I think that's just fine because we've had a good run and we need some help. So the short answer to your question is I think women love these topics more, and I'm happy to be getting into them as they start to really emerge in corporate life as well.
And what are some things that men can do to fully embrace and be better in whether it's leadership roles or relationships? What are some challenges that men have, particularly if there are any?
Well, they're less attuned on average in general. I'm making some generalities here, but they're less attuned to emotions and the role of emotions in relationships. And the only way you really start to sense those is to speak less, to advocate for yourself less and listen more and look and observe and say to yourself, what is this person experiencing right now? And be serious when you ask yourself that question. Until you legitimately, honestly start asking that question, you're going to continue to look at the surface of them, not think deeper about it, and advocate for yourself. So one part of any relationship improvement plan, if you will, is people getting over themselves a little bit more and trying to listen as much as they talk and genuinely seek to understand the other person. Because if you don't understand them, what good are you? You're not solving the right problem. Bottom line, you're not solving the right problem. So we've got to do more of that. I would say men have to appreciate emotion more and listen more than they advocate for themselves, so to speak.
Great stuff. Before we wrap up, and I'm very appreciative of your time, Todd, this has been really good. It's interesting to me, maybe this is just a confirmation bias or attention bias, but it's interesting to me that while technology and the ability to speak at scale on the internet to the world, effectively, that as that has happened, the drift towards real life events and actually showing up in person to hear somebody speak has also grown. What are some tips or some experiences you've had that would encourage or help people to step into the role of speaking, whether that's to 5 people in a team, 12 people in a boardroom, or 200 people in an auditorium?
Certainly. I mean, they're obviously different audiences, but there's some generalities there. I'd love to tell people this. It is a skill. I know some of you are born more naturally inclined to communicate as a speaker, whether it's small group, large group, whatever. But even though you've got your baseline that you're born with, it is a skill, which means through effort, you can learn to be better at it. That's a very important message to share with people, whether it's an executive or someone who's aspiring to be a professional speaker like me. So there's different answers to that. One is speak more, not less. Go find opportunities. At work, you can start a brown bag. You can volunteer to give the client presentation. There's a lot of ways to do it. Outside of work, you have civic groups who need speakers. You have business associations everywhere who need monthly speakers. You have Toastmasters, if you've never heard of them. They are a wonderful group for low fees that will help create a safe, productive environment for people to stand up and learn how to speak more effectively. And you have colleagues. You know, one of the best things to do to present, which people don't do hardly ever, which kills me as a teacher type person, is to practice before they present. So at work, just think of being the normal person at work. You got to do a presentation maybe once a month to some group. People will show up. They'll do their slides. They'll look through the slides maybe once. They'll show up. They'll do the presentation, and they'll perform average. But if you'll actually go find 5 colleagues, one of whom you know is cantankerous and will give you biting feedback, and you'll do it for them twice and let them rip you, you will learn something and go before the real group and do better. So I'm saying nothing complex other than practice and feedback are terribly useful, and trying to be encouraging by reminding your listeners it is a skill. And whether it's your colleagues or a course, I've got a course on presentations on LinkedIn Learning, or whether it's Toastmasters, you go find the resource that you're most comfortable with and start building that skill.
Excellent. Dr. Todd Dewitt, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Before I wrap up, can you let people know how they can find out more about you or access more of your content or resources?
Sure. You can just go to my home on the web, which is drdewitt.com, www.drdewett.com.
Good stuff. Todd, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this and looking forward to hearing it back.
Excellent, man. Thanks so much.
Shane here again, really, really quickly before I let you go. First of all, thank you so, so much for listening all the way to the end. I know that 1 hour interviews are a significant investment of the most valuable asset that you have, your time. And so I never, ever take that for granted. So thank you so much. If something in this episode resonated with you particularly, I'd be fantastically grateful if you could take a screenshot of the episode on your phone, on your computer, wherever you've listened to it, and share it out on whatever social media or social network makes most sense for you. That helps me spread the word. It helps me get this mission to as many people as possible. And I'm very, very grateful for your support to make that happen. The mission of the Life Well Lived project is to provide support, guidance, and inspiration for people all over the world to overcome their own challenges, to explore and embrace their own one time in history uniqueness, and to live lives of energy, purpose, and happiness. That is the mission of everything I'm doing. That is the mission of this podcast and this project. And whatever support you can give to help me get this message, this show to new audiences, to new people, I am hugely grateful for that. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I have lots more in the pipeline, lots more coming up over the rest of 2019 and into 2020. If this is your first time here, please do feel free to check out the back catalogue on the archive on my website, shanebreslin.com, or in whatever your favourite podcast app is. That's all for me. Thank you again for downloading this episode. Thank you again for tuning in. And thank you so much for listening to all the way to the end. Shane signing off, and I'll chat to you again soon. Bye-bye.